Thank you. Thank you very much, Jason. And many thanks to Jim and Nicole and everybody else for arranging this workshop and letting me come, even though I confirmed so very, very late. It's really so kind of you. It's a wonderful occasion for me. I feel a little bit incompetent. One reason is that I feel that almost everybody here must know much more by now about Hatha Yoga and physical practices, because I have the handicap of having, alas, missed the first 2 days of the workshop. I arrived late. Nonetheless, I will try to do a little bit of what Jim asked me to do, which is to speak about Buddhist tantric yoga, and especially something about physical practices, he said. Well. that's for me, it is not the easiest thing to do, to speak about that, I feel, but I am going to try a little bit. However, I now think that what I'm going to talk about is sort of the first half of a two-part thing, so if you have another workshop, perhaps I can try to give you the second half. So this is going to be, I'm afraid, the more theoretical part, but again, I'm simply not ready yet to give the second half very well. For instance, because I have not yet studied the Amrita Siddhi, which, as we heard this morning, is almost certainly one of the most important texts for understanding the development of Buddhist physical practices as part of yoga. So this is the first part of a talk on the body in Buddhist tantric yoga. And the way I have decided to try to do this is to present a Purva Paksha first, and then try to give an answer to that. So the first, the handout has some text passages divided in somehow under one and two. One is the Purva Paksha. Now you have to understand, however, this does not mean that these text passages come from passages arguing this Purva Paksha. Rather, you have to understand the Purva Paksha, let us say for the moment, is an imaginary one. Maybe it is not entirely imaginary, but I'll come back to that later. The Purva Paksha is an imagined position for the moment, which says that something like, the formulation I put down there, something like, the body is of no importance, or virtually of no importance, in tantric Buddhist yoga. Yoga is purely mental. Okay, this is the Purva Paksha. And again, the passages that we are going to look at are not necessarily actually trying to say that. Instead, there are passages which might perhaps be adduced by somebody who might hold such a paksha. So if somebody might have such a paksha, such a view, he might start by saying, for instance, that, or arguing in the following way. In Buddhist texts, yoga is frequently defined as, or equated with, bhavana. And this equation, or this gloss, or identification, implies, my imaginary Purva Paksha says, that yoga is chiefly or entirely mental activity. It is activity of mind, citta, or vijnana, not activity of the body. And this equation of yoga with bhavana also could be argued by my imaginary opponent to mean that yoga is basically a type of insight or wisdom, prajna. Because the word bhavana has a very strong association with prajna. Wisdom is commonly said in Mahayana Buddhist theory to be shuttamayi, to have three types consisting of shuttamayi, chintamayi, and bhavanamayi. Okay, something like you first study something, just hear a text or try to understand a text, then reflect on it, chinta, and then this bhavana of it. Okay, so this equation again can be taken to suggest that yoga is basically some kind of insight meditation. And the Purva Paksha might continue. It is bhavana alone, or bhavana mayi prajna, so it is this mental cultivation or meditation, a type of insight. It is this alone which is directly soteriologically relevant. Now I quote a few passages which might be used by my Purva Paksha. The first is a verse from the commentary on the Hevajra by Ratnakara Shanti. So he is an important teacher of the first half of the 11th century. Shrutam asati na bodhe, na shrute chasti chinta, dvaya vipadina yogo, yoga hana na siddhi. Iti chiram ihatam tretapam utkantitaram, haratu hridini padda, hanta muktavaliyam. He elegantly refers to the name of his own commentary. The commentary is called Muktavali. And the verse is fairly straightforward, I'm sure, for most of the Sanskrit students here, except that the word order is just a little bit off-putting at first, but what he is saying is something like, if you do not have Bodha, now Bodha could mean something very high, let us say, something like realization, but here it simply means basic understanding of the words and of the sentences. So he's saying, asati bodhe, if you do not have this basic understanding, na shrutam, you do not have shruta, learning, but here it means that shruta mi prajna, the lowest level of wisdom. Na shruti chasti chinta, and if you do not have the lowest level, then you cannot have the next level of chinta, of reflection. Dvaya vipadi means dvaya bhave, if there is no shruta and chinta mayi prajna, if you do not have this lower level. Na yogaha, and here is a case, as I said, this can be quoted by my Purvapakshan, here yoga is a synonym of bhavana. There is no yoga without having shrutami and chintamayi prajna. Yoga hana na siddhihi, and if you don't have this yoga equals bhavana, there cannot be any siddhi, accomplishment or success. So, iti, for those people who have long been very eager to understand and then study and ultimately do the yoga of this tantra, my hope is that this Muktavali commentary, and the name of the commentary, that this name Muktavali means a string of pearls. I hope that this commentary of mine, Muktavali, like a string of pearls, when placed on the heart or taken to heart, there's a nice pun here too. A string of pearls is worn, it rests on the chest, and the commentary is supposed to be taken to heart, let us say. So I hope, my hope is that this string of pearls, this commentary, may remove the suffering of those who have been very eager to study this tantra. Okay, and what he means to say is actually relatively modest. He means to say that his commentary will allow the readers to get that bodha, which is the first requirement, just to understand the words of the tantra. And once they have that, they can develop shrutamayi, then chintamayi, and finally bhavanamayi prajna equals yoga. Okay, so this sounds like a case where yoga one could argue that here it's very clear yoga means bhavana, and it is specifically bhavana of that bhavana mi prajna type because of the whole set being present here. And for the point that only prajna is directly soteriologically effective, my Purvapakshan might quote, for instance, Dharmakirti, Muktistu Shunyata Drishtes, Tadartha Shesha Bhavana. You occasionally find variant readings in this verse, but these are the readings that I prefer. And the meaning is something like, liberation, however, comes about through seeing emptiness, and the seeing emptiness, shunyata drishti, is obviously, for Buddhists, it is a prajna, wisdom. And all other, or cultivation of anything else, is only aims at helping you develop that. And this line is not from a tantric text, but it is very often, it is from a Brahmana text, Dharmakirti, but it is rather often quoted by tantric authors with approval. And similarly from Shantideva's Bodhicharyavatara, another passage which maybe I will skip so as not to use too much time, but again, it is a passage which seems to be saying very clearly that it is prajna that produces the desired result, and everything else only is a kind of assistance to that. That's what it seems to say. Okay, so this is the first line, perhaps, that I imagine my Purvapakshan taking. Now, the Purvapakshan may continue by quoting the passage on the second page of your handout, 1b, a passage which seems to be telling us that the importance of mind and body, respectively, is comparable to that of a wish-fulfilling jewel, the mind is like a wish-fulfilling jewel, and a heap of garbage. Okay, it is again from Ratnakara Shanti, the opening of his commentary on the Sarva Rahasya Tantra. Okay, maybe to save time again just a little bit, I won't read it in Sanskrit. He says that the first verse of the Tantra is spoken by the Buddha, by the Bhagavan, in order to urge people who are too fond of those things that sort of nurture the body. They are too fond of good food, comfortable beds, etc. And they think that bodhi, that awakening, can only be achieved through very tough practice, physically tough practice for a very long time of the perfections of generosity, etc. Okay. So they're rather fond of their comfortable beds and the nice food, and they think that, well, if I'm to become a Buddha, I'm going to have to really torment my body. Okay. So to urge such people to nonetheless practice for Bodhi, Bodha Protsahanaya, the Buddha teaches the opening verse to let them realize that actually the body is just like a heap of garbage, and mind, on the other hand, is like a wish-fulfilling jewel. Okay. As I say again, I'm not saying that Ratnakara Shanti holds my Purva Paksha at all, but just that the Purva Paksha might say, well, look at this. Here he's saying that it is the mind that fulfills everything, and the body is very unimportant. And I continue the next part of the Purva Paksha's argument, 1c. The Purva Paksha may point to the fact that in texts teaching tantric Buddhist meditation, one is often told that as part of the preliminaries, for instance, usually part of the preliminaries, the ordinary body has to be removed, that is to say, dissolved, through meditation. And he might quote passages such as this very, very short one here, not even a complete sentence, but the key word there is prakrita sharira abhavam drishva, visualizing the non-existence of the ordinary body. Okay. And you find, of course, many similar formulations. And finally, for the moment, I give my Purva Paksha only so much space. Finally, for the moment, he may say that if we look at the philosophical or theoretical underpinnings of tantric Buddhist practice, it also makes sense to say that the mind yoga is purely yoga of the mind. For, here I have not actually quoted any passages under 1D. Of course, many passages could be quoted, but instead I just summarize. Buddhist tantric teachers basically are all either yogacara or madhyamaka in philosophical orientation. I think this is without exception as far as I can see, or at least without any clear exceptions. And, well, the yogacarans claim that external objects, so-called, do not exist as such, okay, and this includes the body. Deha bhoga pratishtha is the old formulation of yogacara. So instead of my body being actually something separate from my mind, it is just that my mind arises as the result of the impressions of beginningless ignorance in such a way that it appears to me as, or I have the mistaken cognition of, a body or of the external objects, etc. Now, if this is the case, then the very appearance of my body is an error. It is part of bondage. It is a kind of proof of the fact of my bondage. And indeed, the Purva Paksha could say, there are at least some texts, especially those of a yogacara, tantric texts of a yogacara orientation, which say things such as, all of these appearances of bodies, etc., are purely the sign of error, bhranti chihna, and they have to be actually removed. What the yogin is trying to do is remove them completely through a type of insight meditation or something like that. Okay, so that's for the yogacara side. Then others are perhaps more are Madhyamaka in orientation, but the Madhyamakas do not have more positive attitudes towards external objects, including bodies. No, not at all. Instead, rather you can say something like they go further than the yogacaras. The yogacaras say that mind at least is a reality, whereas the Madhyamakas say mind too actually does not really exist at all. So, if we consider this, okay, sorry, and one more point perhaps under the philosophical underpinning side. Within the Yogacara fold, we have a main division between so-called nirākāra or alikākāra view and sākāra view. And probably the more common view among tantric authors is the nirākāra or alikākāra view. According to this, indeed, the forms such as the form in cognition of a body or an external object, these forms are completely false. Indeed, they are to be eradicated. Okay, if you held the other view, the Sākāra view, maybe there's a little bit more room there for you to, for some positive evaluation of the body. But my Purva Paksha says, okay, the Nirākāra view is very strongly represented. So I conclude my Purva Paksha here. He has stated several arguments. which he feels are reasons to say that in Tantric Buddhism, the body is of virtually no importance. And the important thing is yoga equals bhavana, which is something purely, let us say, mental. Now we come to the Siddhanta. I hope that I presented the Purvapaksha in a way that it was a little bit persuasive, of course. I will now refute it, or try to refute it. But one has to be fair to the other side, and the refutation may convince you more if I presented the Purvapaksha in a strong way. I did it as strong, in as convincing a way as I could manage in relatively short time of preparation. So the Siddhanta is almost opposite. Instead of the body being of no importance or virtual no importance, and yoga being purely a mental activity, the Siddhantan states, the yogin's body is an essential means, or even sometimes perhaps the essential means, for gaining awakening or Buddhahood. And here I quote as my first, statement for the Siddhantan here, is a passage which I have some hopes may be unfamiliar to all of you. I say that because I know that some of you have studied so much Tantric Buddhism that it's very hard to show you a passage that you have not seen. This is perhaps especially the case for Peter Santo, but also for some others here. This one, maybe Peter has also seen it, but I felt there was a tiny chance Peter has not seen this passage. It is from a commentary on the Vyavastoli of Nagabuddhi. This is a work on the sadhana of Gohyo Samaja practice. And this commentary is explaining the word sukshma yogartha tattvajna in a quotation actually from a tantra, from the Sandhya Vyakarana Tantra. This work, the Vyavastoli, maybe around 9th century or so, I forget, quotes this line from the tantra. And the commentator says, well, again, maybe I shouldn't try to read everything in detail, but you see that there's this long compound, sukshma yogartha tattvajna. The jnya part is, of course, obvious. It means somebody who knows what proceeds in the compound. Now, what proceeds in the compound is explained by the commentator as a karmadarya compound. That is to say, it is simply one thing that is being referred to. All of these words refer to the same thing. And the chief word in the compound is the first one, sukshma, which, according to this commentator, means actually yoginaha shariram, the body of the yogin, which, the commentator says, is the cause, or functions as the cause, or more or less the cause, but you can also simply say is the cause, hetu bhuta, of samyak sambodhi, of perfect Buddhahood, that is the goal. And the word that refers to it in the tantra is this word sukshma, which literally means subtle. And the commentator is saying that this word, it is appropriate, or perhaps rather that his interpretation, that sukshma here means the body of the yogin, which is the cause for Buddhahood, is justified by the fact that this body of the yogin is tathagatebhyo, I was not going to read the Sanskrit. It cannot be understood, it is uhabhagata, or it cannot be fathomed, by those other than Buddhas. Only Buddhas can really understand the nature of this body, so it is subtle. Okay, so the subtle thing referred to is actually the yogin's body, according to our commentator. And then it is also called yoga. Okay, the word yoga, as you all know, has many meanings. Here, according to the commentator, it is called yoga in the sense that it is yujyate, it is united with the Tathagatas, Vairochana, etc. And it is also artha, because it is that which is desired. And it is tattva, reality, aviparita, because it is completely free of any distortion or mistake, something like that. Okay, so here we have a more or less direct statement of the Siddhanta position, which is the opposite of the Purvapaksha. This commentator is telling us the body of the yogin is the means to Buddhahood. I proceed to the next part of the Siddhanta. I'm afraid I did not manage to make it really nicely structured so that I, point for point, in the right sequence, answer each of the points which I had put in the mouth of the Purvapaksha. So please forgive this slight lack of proper organization of the material at this point. 2B is about the case of sexual yoga. And here we find several authors. Of course, you have to always bear in mind that Tantric Buddhism is a very diverse thing, which has a long history too. So of course, not everybody will agree with everything in any case. Don't worry. However, I think that at least I'm fairly sure that I'm not presenting anything extremely distortive, and I will let you know if I think that there are some very important differences. On this point, I think indeed it is possible that a majority of authorities, and at least a large number of very important authorities, tell us or let us know clearly that merely imagined sexual union with an imagined or meditatively generated consort is not sufficiently effective. And among passages which one might adduce for this are a very famous passage which is about the case of initiation of Abhisheka in the Vajravali of Abhyakara Gupta, a passage which Alexis has discussed in one of his articles, and maybe Peter too. I'm not sure. But I give you here a different passage, or another statement. And this is from Ratnakara Shanti again. Aha. But first, I see I put an actual statement, more or less, of our Purvapaksha. Up till now, I had spoken as if my Purvapaksha is completely imagined. But now I give you an actual quotation from secondary literature of a position which seems to be almost at least identical with my imagined Purvapaksha. This is from Davidson, 2002. That is to say, it is not from his big book about social history, whatever it was called, but one of his articles, which he worked on at about the same time. And he says here that another consequence of sahaja's dissociation from the physical would be found with the complete interiority of the practice. Okay, so complete interiority of the practice. This is almost my Purvapaksha. So that no longer any physical partner, karma mudra, would be needed or even desirable. Instead, the real goddess, whose form is Gnosis, will be invited as the Gnostic partner, Jnana Mudra. An excellent example of this direction is found in Ratnakara Shanti's Sahaja Yoga Krama, where the good monk discusses a practice only marginally out of place in the secluded halls of the monastery. Sorry, I know that this passage, I've quoted this passage before to some of you. We have to be very grateful to Ronald Davidson, not only for putting together many interesting passages and some interesting ideas, but also for serving for a decade and a half already now as a wonderful source for Peter and for others of good of Purvapakshas for lectures, etc. Here, I must say there's one thing that I do take that somehow annoys me slightly about Davidson's formulation, and that is the words good monk, which seem to have a certain flavor about them of saying that an assumption that Ratnakara Shanti is somehow, I don't know, very conventional or is bound by certain conventions of that Davidson thinks monks are likely to share. I'm not sure. Okay, but my main point is that here he says that Ratnakara Shanti teaches that no karma mudra but a jnana mudra is desirable. But this is based on Davidson's completely failing to understand, I think, what Ratnakara in fact says in the text that he is referring to, the text that he calls Sahaja Yoga Krama. So instead of the good monk being somehow, as Davidson's formulation sort of makes it sound to me, it sounds like he's a slight feeling of looking down on the good monk, perhaps. But actually, Davidson, the good monk was so subtle that he fooled Davidson completely about his actual intentions. Now, to show this in detail, you can read the whole text, and I published long ago annotation on the text, which makes the point clear. For the moment, I will just point to a few things, but it's already perhaps sufficient to show that the Siddhanta position is here right, not the Purvapaksha. So if you look at the Sanskrit here, the first little paragraph, which is actually just one sentence, is about the sexual practice. And here, indeed, it sounds at the beginning as if it is a purely mental concept, perhaps. He says, manasa kanchit aniya, bringing some female mentally. And the only alternative that seems to be mentioned is an alternative between sexual union with this perhaps imagined consort that is expressed here by the with the technical terminology of the Hevajra system, with these odd words, odd for the non-Hevajra reader, kakkole bola vilasam. So that is one possibility, a sexual union with this this female. Or the second possibility is a union within one's own body. Body, by the way, indeed, please note. A union between prajna and upaya, wisdom and means, or female and male, within one's own body. Okay, so two possibilities are union of the yogin as upaya with the consort as wisdom, and the second is union within the yogin's body of both wisdom and means. Exactly how that union is realized within the body is not made clear by this sentence alone, but can be easily understood if you read Ratnakara's writings a little bit more widely. Okay, so the first sentence here is perhaps what a part of what led Davidson to his conclusion, perhaps. But later in the same text, Ratnakara's Shanti says that this yoga is fourfold, Chaturdha Bhavati, and he makes it clear, again, maybe I have to slightly summarize, that these it is fourfold because it goes through four stages in succession. And the highest of these four is called like dream and waking simultaneously, svapna jagarupama. And the reason why it is like dream and waking at the same time is, and here Ratnakara Shanti is really actually quite explicit, he says, bahir vidya yoga janitatva. The reason why it is like the waking state is because in this fourth and again highest stage of yoga, the experience is produced, or the yoga is produced, by union, yoga, with an external consort, bahir vidya. And a little bit later, I skip, he says explicitly again that the four are hierarchical, that each later one arises by the power of the previous one. And why is the last one the best of all? Katam antimaha sarvotraha. Because even though there is a cause of distraction present, the yogin is nonetheless completely concentrated. And here by cause of distraction, he means an actual female partner. This is made clear, or clearer to you perhaps, by the next passage, the last one on the bottom of page 3. This is not from the same text, but it is from the same author's commentary on the Hevajra Tantra. So we are lucky with this author that we can put together. He has left us two texts on the meditational practice, for the two successive stages of that practice, and a commentary on the Tantra. And these are very clearly homogeneous, and we can put them together and things become more clear. So this last passage tells us again rather explicitly that the consort, here called the Kula Vidya, by the way, but also Bahya Vidya, external consort, is not accepted, or not, we do not hold that there is such a consort, Pratama Samadhi Traye, in the first three samadhis. And by the first three samadhis, he means precisely those first three stages of yoga. Because at that time, tadanim, or in those samadhis, she, tasyaha, that is the external consort, is a cause or would be a cause of distraction. So I think putting the passages together, it's very clear. I could go into more detail about the difference between the four and the difference between this this option of the internal union in one's own body. But for my discussion here, the only important thing is that putting all the passages together, it is absolutely clear. You can do the practice with a purely imagined consort, but far from this being preferable, as Davidson says that he is saying, it is rather preparatory. And ultimately, the good monk is saying that union with an external consort, actual physical union with an external consort, is necessary. Okay. If somebody still has doubts about Ratnakrishanti's intention, we can discuss it later. For the moment, I hope to have convinced you that my Purva Paksha is wrong, and Davidson, in as far as he represents basically my Purva Paksha, also is wrong, even in his interpretation of Ratnakrishanti. One reason to choose several passages from Ratnakrishanti here is not just that I have a special fondness for this man's writings, but also because it seems to me that he would be ideal for, or he looks like somebody who would be ideal for my Purva Paksha. Okay, so he should be providing maximal strength of support for my Purva Paksha. Because he is a Yogacara and a Nirakaravadin, and he is one of those people who is constantly saying things like, all these akaras, including of course the akara of the body, are simply false, and that the awakened cognition, or cognition free from error, will not have such appearances at all. So he looks like he would be suitable for my Purva Paksha, but I hope to have shown you in his own words that nonetheless he actually does not hold that Purva Paksha view. So I come now to the question of philosophical underpinning. This is a rather big topic, but I try to, again, just say something very simple and elementary about it. You remember that the Purva Paksha, I had imagined him saying, well, they are all Yogacharas or Madhyamakas. In any case, they cannot possibly believe in the existence of external objects, including the body. External means external to mind. And far from believing those external objects to be real, they believe that their appearance is a symptom of error and is caused by our mistakes, let us say, or the our habitual ignorance. Okay. So the Purva Paksha had tried to argue in such a way and could use this as support for the idea that soteriologically effective yoga must be purely cultivation of mind. Okay. But there is a basic mistake in the assumption of the Purva Paksha. For rather, it is the intention of our authors, including Ratnakrishanti, that cultivation of wisdom alone cannot result in what is desired, namely the state of Samyak Sambodhi, perfect Buddhahood. At best, it can result in an inactive state of freedom from rebirth. Okay, and this inactive state can be either seen as a culminating state. That is the view of Ratnakara, to again check in with one particular individual whom we can locate in more or less in time and space. Okay, so his view is that that is a final state. If we cultivate prajna alone, it is possible to enter this state of freedom from rebirth, and it is final. It is actually a kind of liberation, but it is completely inactive and useless to anybody. This is the state of arhatod. Other tantric teachers hold that this is not a final state, instead that those arhats who practice not Mahayana Buddhism but the so-called Shravakayana, that they enter into a kind of special meditative state in which they are as if dead, you could say, or as if in Nirodha Samapatti, and no activity at all. But ultimately, they somehow get shocked out of it and awoken from this after some incredibly long period, and then they suddenly realize that they had not, after all, reached the final goal, and then that they somehow enter into the Mahayana, into the Bodhisattva path. Okay, so there are some different views about this, what is agreed is that cultivation of wisdom alone does not actually result in the goal. And this you can find, again, I'm sorry that I did not give you an actual textual passage under 2C, but I referred you, for instance, to a long excursus, several pages, with a Purva Paksha that is somewhat close to our imagined Purva Paksha, though maybe not exactly identical with it. And with an answer to that Purva Paksha, you can find this again in Ratnakrishanti's own writings in the first chapter of the Muktavali. I think this is one of the main points as for the question of philosophical underpinning, but there are also others, and I mentioned for the moment in your handout only one other. And this is the idea which is rather central in Mahayana and tantric and non-tantric Buddhism, the idea of the union or identity or fusion, sometimes expressed by the word Yogananda, by the way, of the two truths, conventional and ultimate. Okay, so instead of it being the case that we simply have to eliminate the so-called conventional reality or conventional truth and realize only Paramartha, ultimate truth, instead, that might perhaps fit with the Purvapaksha. But instead, if we consider more carefully what the authors are saying, there's this idea of ultimately realizing the identity or union of the two truths. Okay? And to mention one final further point, which is not on your handout, for the philosophical underpinnings, you could also say this is parallel to the idea of the Buddha being not only Dharmakaya. Dharmakaya sort of corresponds to this prajna side, to this wisdom side, pure non-conceptual awareness, which seems at least to be inactive. But the Buddha, Mahayana authors agree, basically, is not just a Dharmakaya. In fact, in a sense, the Buddha is not the Dharmakaya at all, but that's a rather complicated question. To put it simply, the Buddha is Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Nirmanakaya. And these two other bodies, by the way, again body, Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya, they are not completely formless, completely without any duality. On the contrary, they are indeed bodies. So one possible strategy for the philosophical underpinning of Buddhist tantric practice is to say that within the practice, the yogin has to somehow cultivate both. He has to cultivate a non-dual awareness, which ultimately results in achievement of the Dharmakaya. But at the same time, he has to do something with the body, let us say, which will ultimately result in transformation of the body, or in his achieving of these other two bodies of a Buddha, the Sambhoga and Nirmanakaya. So that was about the philosophical underpinning side. And there's a final part on your handout, but I'm very sorry that the handout simply trails off at this point because of my lack of having prepared properly. I wanted here to introduce a number of further ideas, but for the moment, just one or two very tiny things here. First of all, I had meant to give you some of the exegesis which can be found in several commentators, not only Ratnakara, on a line, an expression in the Hevajra Tantra. Deha bhave kutah saukhyam. If you have no body, how can there be bliss? Okay. So for the moment, I didn't have time to collect those passages and give them to you, but I give you that single part for your further thought. Deha bhave kutah saukhyam. And the very last thing, which I see I managed to somehow mistype, is again Ratnakara. Again, to show you that this apparently so theoretical author and so philosophical, with his emphasis on Yogacara of a very conservative seeming type, that nonetheless he puts strong emphasis, you could say, on physical practices. This is just part of the commentary on the name of the first chapter of the Hevajra. And the name in his reading is Vajrakulapatala. And as I say, you'll find it rather difficult to read this, partly because I completely mistyped something. But the key point for us for the moment is that he explains the word kula here. So the chapter is called Vajra Kula, Vajra family. He explains the word kula first with griha, house, or house, let's say house. And then what does it really mean? It means yoginaha swadeha, the yogin's own body. And then actually what he intends to say here is that what Vajrakula really means in the name of this chapter is meditation or cultivation, and he does use the word bhavana, though now you notice in the neuter, the neuter or feminine is not a big deal probably for you. Vajrakula actually means the bhavana, the cultivation of the yogin's body. And this is related, though again I would need to quote a little bit more, I'm afraid, to make the point more clear, to the fact that in the higher, precisely in the higher stages of practice for Ratnakara Shanti, indeed, it is very much about the body. So again, you remember that the Purvapakshan says, my Purvapakshan, my imaginary one, says, well, these authors very often tell us you have to first completely dissolve your ordinary body, and everything is happening then purely meditatively. But for Ratnakara Shanti, this is true, I think, basically for the lower stage of tantric practice. But in the higher stage of tantric practice, the yogin's body is of extraordinary importance, and it indeed becomes, as it were, the principal means for Buddhahood. So that was as much as I managed to prepare for you. Again, I'm very sorry that this is only the introduction of the theoretical side. But yes, I hope that I convinced you that the Purvapaksha is probably wrong. thank you very much. And I forgot to thank at the beginning, again, the Royal Asiatic Society, too, because it is very nice to be here. And I only learned yesterday that I was to give my second lecture here, the first one having been 15 years ago, exactly.
So we have 15 minutes for questions and discussion.
A typo in the last passage.
Well, the main... Sorry, the main thing which I noted just now was that I somehow managed to type swadeho yasya. Ah. And if that were right, then the analysis of the compound becomes very confusing. But that should be at least swadehas tasya, exactly. Sorry, I don't know how I got that one wrong.
And earlier also the sahaja maja, that is...
Oh, sorry, that is my typo for maha, exactly. Mahajnana. Yeah, yeah, that one is maha. Not sahaja jnana, but sahaja mahajnana, because the word mahajnana occurred in this chapter earlier, that is why. Thank you. Sorry, that last passage was the last one I typed, full of errors. But at least, yes, I say, the key point is just to note that he is giving this gloss of kula as meaning actually the yogin's own body, and he's saying that this is really about teaching the bhavana of that. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
Yes.
You just said that.
Okay. I don't know which level of clarity you want. Maybe it's enough to say. Kakula here is a synonym for Padma. Maybe this is sufficient. And Bola for Vajra. Bila, of course, is in its normal usage. It is a synonym of Randra, etc.
thank you, Harry. On page 2 of the Purvapaksha, I was just wondering the first line of the passage there from Ranaka again. Dirga Dushkara Dana, you said that it was tough, difficult practices.
Yeah, something like that. So if you want to indeed go into the level of the words, that word is an adjective to bodhi, as we can see. So to urge towards awakening, those people who think, manyamana, that bodhi is something of which the only means to its achievement or actualization, ekasadhana, is the practice, charya, of dana, etc., the paramitas, beginning with dana. And this practice is dirga, long. It has to be to go on for 3 asankhya kalpas or kalpa asankhyas, and dushkara, just too tough. We can expand on the idea here with the help of parallel passages, for instance. So the toughness consists in the fact that we are told that the Buddha himself did such things in many lives as cutting off part of his own flesh to feed hungry tigers, to help a hungry tigress feed her cubs, etc., or giving his eyes, or even his life, etc. Okay, so for people... especially Dana. Yes, yeah. So people who are thinking, oh, that's too tough for me, but to nonetheless urge them to come on, to get on with it and start practicing towards bodhi, he is saying, oh, that body is so unimportant. The mind is the thing that gives everything, something like that. Yeah.
Not much related to the present context, but the Dharmakirtika probably Ashesha Bhavana is better.
As I mentioned, there are different readings there. Also, sometimes we find the... I like this reading the best.
Why?
Yes, it means sheshanam bhavana. So it means everything other than shunyata drishti.
But if shunyata is the result, mm-hmm. bhavana can be anaraka.
No, shunyata is not the result, it is the means. Muktistu shunyata drishtehi, and that means through prajna we achieve liberation. Cultivation of all the other things is only tadartha means shunyata drishyartha, means prajnartha. So I think indeed he means more or less the same as Shantideva when he says imam parikaram sarvam prajnartham. Prajnartham he means. So I like this reading better, but you're right, I think some people may have read it as Ashesha.